I'm John Kroll. Today on this special pre-recorded edition of No Limits, we're going to talk about interfaith dialogue. Few divisions in history have had as profound an impact on human beings as those involving faith traditions. Faith is at the core of many people's lives, which makes it all the more important that we learn to talk across those lines of division. We will talk today about how effectively we're doing that, about what we're doing right, and about where the challenges are. We will talk not just about where we are, but also where we can go and where we should go. We will discuss all of this with our guests, Franklin College Professor David Carlson, Rabbi Paula Wenig of the Bureau of Jewish Education, and Indiana University Indianapolis Professor Julie Bells. Please stay with us for a lively discussion about one of the things that matters most to people, faith. Now, the day's news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism and executive editor of thestatehousefile.com, as well as your host. In this special pre-recorded edition of No Limits, today we are talking about issues of faith and the importance of interfaith dialogue. We're fortunate to have as our guests David Carlson, who is a professor of philosophy and religion at Franklin College. David, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, John. Thank you.
It's good to have you here. I probably should do a quick disclosure. Obviously, David and I work together at Franklin College, so that the audience knows that. We also are fortunate to be joined by Paula Wenig, who is with the Bureau of Jewish Education. Paula, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
It is good to have you here. And this one I'm going to have to take a deep breath for. This is a complicated title. Dr. Julie Bells, who is at Indiana University, Indianapolis. She is the Associate Professor of Applied Linguistics, English, and World Languages and Cultures. She is also the editor of Internet-Mediated Intercultural Foreign Language Education. I got through all of it in one breath. Julie, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
It's good to have you here. I should also mention that David Carlson is the author of a new book, Peace Be With You. Well, we're here to talk a little bit about the importance of interfaith dialogue and talking across faith traditions. I think I'd like to start with, see if we can establish a benchmark here. How well are we doing at this point? David Carlson, I'll start with you.
I think we have great opportunities right now for interfaith dialogue. Even at a time with great stress and tension and perhaps misunderstanding between religions, there is this opportunity that's developed really post 9/11 that has been very unique, I think, in our country. As a sense that we need to move in this direction. If religions are going to help us build bridges to one another instead of walls, we're going to have events like this where we're together and sharing our own perspectives, but also modeling respect for other traditions.
Well, I'll ask the same question to Dr. Julie Bells.
You know, John, it was recently at an interfaith event here in the city that I was reminded by Rabbi Jerry Sirota of the D.C. area about the strong vision and strong injunction in the Quran for interfaith dialogue. It's really part of our faith. And I'm going to read a verse from the Quran. It's 49:13. It says, "O mankind, we have created you from a male and a female, and made you into nations and tribes, not so that you will despise one another, but so that you will come to know one another." And I really think that I agree with my colleague next to me that we are at a good point in time for moving forward in interfaith dialogue, and I hope to highlight some of the things that the Muslim community has been involved in.
Paul Wenig, how are we doing right now? What is the status, really, of interfaith dialogue?
Well, I guess it depends whether you're talking about locally or nationally. Mm-hmm. I have to say, listening to WFYI and listening to the news reports out of different areas going through primary election campaigns, that I don't share their optimism. I think the quotes that I heard just a few days ago talking about how support for one candidate, and I'll try not to be overly political, shows that they're reinstilling Christianity and Christian faith where it should be at the heart of American politics, and that Barack Obama as a Muslim shouldn't be leaving this leading this country, as if A, if he were a Muslim, that would be bad, and B, that he's, of course, not a Muslim and is deeply involved in his own Christian faith as a guiding force in his own life and vision for the world, I'm not certain we're doing so well. I think there's a lot of wonderful local things happening all around the nation. But I think the political discourse on a national basis and perhaps even on a state basis is not so very optimistic.
David Carlson. Yeah.
Yes, I really agree with that. I think that you can see a lot of what I call fear-based language in the politics currently. I personally think that our three perceptions go together well. I think that fear is indicative that the world is moving on, that our nation is moving on, that religious diversity is a reality. And I am a political junkie, I have to admit that. And when I listen to that language, I'm hearing what I call the Walton's Mountain mentality. Let's move back to a time when Christianity
was the happy, carefree days of the Depression.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So I take that as kind of an indication that we're going to need some help as a nation to move together with respect, because one of the first instincts when we sense diversity is fear. And I think we see that in the language that we're hearing.
Well, and I had planned to have us talk a little bit about that, because, you know, just to pick one instance, and I don't know if this is the one that Paula Winnick was referring to, Rick Santorum, who's one of the candidates, saying that the famous speech that John F. Kennedy made, outlining what he owes to his faith and what he would owe to his office were he elected president, made him want to throw up. And we've seen other instances of that. Are those obstacles to creating that kind of outburst, as it were? Is that an obstacle to creating dialogue across faith traditions? Dr. Julie Bells.
I think this is what I would call a lingua cultural rupture.
Mm-hmm.
In academia, we have been studying intercultural communication for decades.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm an expert in intercultural communication. It's one of the things that I research. So we have developed theories and frameworks for moving forward with this type of interaction. And I think that we can borrow these types of frameworks and apply them to the larger public discourse that we see out there, like comments by Rick Santorum. So this is a moment when things like this happen in the public discourse where we need trained and educated individuals who can take those moments and turn those into learning moments.
And to be fair, on the other end of the political spectrum, you have some folks who say that, issues of faith should have absolutely no role in public discourse. Is there a problem with that, David Carlson?
I just want to maybe go back to the previous comment.
Sure.
I
do want to address that, too. But
yeah.
Go ahead.
I was really moved. I was asked in the fall to design a program for a fairly conservative Christian church south of Indianapolis, south of Franklin. And in working with them, they wanted an interfaith understanding. And it wasn't clear at the beginning of our conversation what they wanted the understanding for. Did they want the understanding for ways that they could more effectively evangelize Muslims, Jews, and Buddhists? Or did they want the understanding to be, in a sense, understanding of respect for the spirituality and the faith lives of other people? I proposed the latter, and I designed a four-week series in which the two middle weeks was, first week was a dialogue with a Jewish representative and a Muslim father and mother from the same community, because they wanted to hear local people that they might know. And they came, and we had a dialogue in front of this and with this fairly conservative Christian group. And then the third week we had Buddhist representatives and a Hindu representative. And what came out of that for me was a real sense of affirmation. And that is people, even to the very conservative end of the theological spectrum, mm-hmm. Want an alternative to this fear-based and often hate-related language. And I was expecting certain comments to come from the audience. I was kind of waiting for certain what I thought might be typical objections to believing that others mm-hmm. could have a God consciousness that mm-hmm. was as deep as this particular community's. It was a very moving experience for me because the whole community seemed to move right toward what we were talking about, what we need to do in society in terms of not settling for the low hurdle of tolerance, mm-hmm. which is often, I don't know about you, you don't know about me, let's keep it that way. That's not going to work any longer. Mm-hmm. To move to the higher goal of understanding how someone else in another tradition can find meaning in life through that tradition and to respect that and perhaps even encourage it.
I want to take a step back because I think we all three of you at one point have talked about moving past the fear to some degree. Where does that fear come from? Why is it such a profound hurdle? Dr. Julie Bells, and then I'll go to Paula Winning.
I think that the fear comes from lack of education. We need more systematic multicultural education within our K-12 system. I think it would be a good idea to follow some European models of education that are out there, which encourage the teaching of comparative religions.
Paula Winning.
I would actually go a step further. Mm-hmm. I'm not certain that the goal is tolerance. Mm-hmm. I think the goal is understanding. Tolerance says, I'm better than you are, and I'm going to tolerate your presence. Mm-hmm. True understanding, true knowledge means that I'm secure with who I am, and I accept my faith at my level for my own tradition and my immediate community, and I want to, from my faith community, learn about somebody else mm-hmm. and understand where they are and be able to take in the depth and the beauty of where they are, even if it's not where I am. Even if I look at those traditions and say, not only do I not accept them for myself, I don't even really grasp the truth and connection because I can't. It's not my faith tradition. But how beautiful it is for somebody else be so deeply connected and find what they're doing so meaningful. And furthermore, I think, of course, the most important part about all faith tradition is what we do with our faith, mm-hmm. how we put our faith traditions into action. And does our faith actually make us the better people I think every faith tradition demands of us to be? And without that godliness in our actions, how we believe is probably not as important to the greater scheme of the world. And I think that often gets missed in all these faith dialogue discussions.
David Carlson.
100% agreement on that. At the end of the book of interviews that I did, through the interviews, it came very clear to me that interfaith dialogue gets all bogged down when it talks about, do we agree on the nature of God? And that is when people say we should just say everybody has their own route to the top of the same summit. We should just agree with that. But most conservative people, either Christians, and I would suggest Muslims and Jews as well, would not accept that all religions are just different paths to the same goal. Mm-hmm. But I do think we have a common summit that we can ascend together, and that is the sacredness of the neighbor. I think that comes through in what your comment is, Paula. And I think at the heart of all religions is this idea that the neighbor is sacred. And therefore, that's the better mountain to climb.
We are talking about issues of faith and the importance of interfaith dialogue on this special pre-recorded edition of No Limits. Our guests are David Carlson, Franklin College professor, Paula Winning of the Bureau of Jewish Education, and Professor Julie Bells of Indiana University, Indianapolis. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, executive editor of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. On this special pre-recorded edition of No Limits, we are talking about issues of faith and the importance of interfaith dialogue. My guests are David Carlson, who is Franklin College professor of philosophy and religion, Rabbi Paula Winnig with the Bureau of Jewish Education, Dr. Julie Bells of Indiana University, Indianapolis. Before the break, we were talking really about moving past the fear and moving beyond something that, well, we said tolerance is too low a threshold. How do we get then, in terms of elevating the dialogue, how do we do that? Rabbi Winnig.
I think education is the key. I think education of children and adults, but particularly children, to get to know what it actually means, first and foremost, to be of their own faith, and secondly, then to know what it means to expect equal understanding of other people's traditions. I dare say if you took any normal elementary or middle school classroom and asked them to fill out a survey of what their own faith believes, they may get two or three things, and they wouldn't be the main tenets. They would know more about a ritual or a food or when they get presents than anything about their own real deep-seated faith traditions, because that's the way, unfortunately, we feed tradition to people today. And they certainly wouldn't know much positive about anybody else's faith. They might know, again, a thing or two, and unfortunately much of it would be on a negative plane of it's not this or it's that or it's this bad tradition. And I think education and understanding is the key. And I also think combating the negative in public discourse and public view, like some of the things that go on TV, stereotyping people's faith, and that goes on in political discourse unchallenged, is really destructive to a knowledge-based view of the world.
Such as, you know,
When people claim that Barack Obama is of a different faith than he really is, something that has been discussed ad nauseum and is still coming up in political campaigns.
Well, and I know one of the things that that since I come from obviously a journalism background, I know that the editors at the Indianapolis Star a couple of years ago caught all kinds of grief because they made note someone had accused Obama of not belonging to the church that he does, and they, you know, said, but he does, in fact, belong to this, made the editor's note, and people said, well, how can you say that? A lot of the folks who disagreed with them did that. So it creates a challenge there, even when we can't agree on, the facts involved. I know everyone wants to get in on this subject, so it's almost going to be like a classroom here. I'm going to go with the person who got the hand up first, and that's Dr. Julie Bells.
I wanted to express my agreement with many of the things that Rabbi Paula Winnig said. First of all, I want to say that, you know, when we're thinking about interfaith dialogue, which is a type of intercultural dialogue, the participants in that type of dialogue express that with fear. They approach that with fear. And I think one of the reasons they approach it with fear is because they misunderstand what is meant by dialogue. Mm-hmm. They think that getting in a dialogue means that the person you're in a dialogue with is trying to change your point of view. Mm-hmm. And that's really not the academic understanding of dialogue. Actually, dialogue oftentimes results in irreducible paradoxical confrontations. Not confrontation in a negative sense, but confrontation like what Rabbi Winnig was talking about, that when you enter into an interfaith dialogue, it really is an act of learning about yourself as much as it is an act of learning about the other. And I want to offer a definition of intercultural competence from a British scholar called Michael Byrum. And he refers to intercultural competence as the ability to see the self through the eyes of the other. And I think that it's this attitude of seeing the self through the eyes of the other that we really need to strive for and put to the forefront when we're approaching and engaging in intercultural, interreligious dialogue.
David Carlson.
The educational piece, I think, is fundamental. foundational. The next step, I think, is the experience of being in dialogue with someone else. And I really pick up on what was just mentioned. One of the persons that is sort of the key of the work that I did was I imagined that I could do an interview with Thomas Merton, who post 9/11, who happened to die in 1968. But well, I felt
there would be some logistical challenges.
Some problems. But through all his writings, yeah. I found a great deal that he was speaking, at least to me, about, and I think to my readers. One of the things that Merton shows us is that the fear of interfaith communication, dialogue, being in the same room together like we are now, there's a fear on some people's parts that if they do this and they enjoy it, that they have now a diluted love and respect for their own tradition. And what Merton did was change the paradigm. And through his own experiences of dialogue with Buddhists, Jews, Muslims, atheists, he demonstrated that, in fact, through dialogue, in his case, in my case, I become a better Christian. That, in fact, I need the experience of others in other traditions with their understanding of God consciousness, that it does not remove me from my love of my faith, but in fact it encourages me to deepen my own understanding, my own experience of my faith. And for me, this has been a tremendous opening for my students as well, who love their religious faith, but are now in a world of great religious diversity. And they want to know how to move forward. Are they going to lose their faith if they respect other faiths? And the answer is, doesn't have to be that way at all. This can be just a very powerful experience, and I'll give one personal example. Mm-hmm. In the dialogue with the church last month, the young woman from the Muslim faith who was there speaking really challenged me. So I shared on the fourth week with my conservative Christian brothers and sisters. I said that I had been very moved by something she said. My own prayer life tends to be a morning experience and an evening experience. And, of course, the Muslim point of view is there's five times of prayer, at least fixed, and, of course, you can pray at other times as well.
Muslim and Jewish.
And Jewish, right. Mm-hmm. And in monastic traditions, five to seven times a day. And I shared with the group that because of that dialogue experience in being with Allah, I was now praying at noon, figuring at the middle of the day I needed a time to kind of, you know, take a little perspective. And I think that's what happens in true dialogue, is that I'm not trying to pull you away from Jewishness, you pull mm-hmm. away from of being Muslim. You're not trying to pull me anywhere, but we're all potentially going deeper, and in that depth, we come to see that we actually need one another.
Rabbi Paul Owenig, I'm going to ask each of you this, because what David Carlson has just said here is that out of the dialogue, it actually deepens his own faith, his commitment to his own faith. Has that been your experience, too, in these situations? That
the experience can be that. I'm not certain it always is. I grew up in northern Wisconsin in a very small town where I was one of 50 Jews. Okay. My entire experience of my childhood and much of my adult life is being very much in the minority in every way, shape, and form. And there is no question that that is faith-forming and identity-forming if you are raised to be proud of your differences and know how to live in that context. A lot of people aren't. And unfortunately, what ends up happening is not what Dr. Bells was describing of this intercultural communication that elevates everybody. Mm-hmm. In fact, most people end up coming out of a lot of these interfaith dialogues saying, see, I really showed them, or is sort of triumphal that they made a point and got somebody. I used to be on a part of a TV program in New York mm-hmm. that was an interfaith TV program. And, mm-hmm. and many times it was really this incredibly powerful experience until one or two of the participants would try to make it political. And then everything that we had built up, all the trust, all the beauty, would be taken out of the experience because somebody had a political agenda that became more important than the social, cultural, emotional, faith-based agenda. And that's always the danger with interfaith dialogue. which way is it going to go? How strong is the moderator? How strong is the commitment to making the best come out? As Dr. Bells was quoting the Quran, that Quranic passage, which Rabbi Sirota taught, is also based on a rabbinic midrash. I would bet there is almost nobody, Jewish or Muslim, who understands how interconnected our spiritual traditions are based on these kinds of commentaries that evolved and commingled and grew into beautiful expressions of tradition and faith that don't exist. Same thing with Christian scripture.
Now, is that the same? And I am going to continue this, but I find this piece of the discussion just fascinating because my observation has been often with the more conservative elements in every faith tradition, if you try to emphasize that commonality, it provokes immediate resistance across the board. Why is that, and how do you circumvent it? Because it is factually based. It's sort of like the argument you make about Barack Obama and his faith, or whether he's 6'1" as opposed to 5'2". It's something that can be demonstrated. Yeah.
Actually, it comes back to that fear, and I go back to it. Is it not? It's not fear of the other so much as fear of themselves. One of the things I find fascinating about people who are retreating to the incredibly conservative, walled-in type of faith, to the point where they don't even want to see the other, much less live among or dialogue with the other, is because they're very afraid that their faith can't stand up to the outside world. One of the things I don't fear about, and for myself, is I don't fear that my faith can't stand up to the outside world. I know who I am. I know what I believe. I know my traditions. And I know that my life has been enhanced by them. And I don't fear that somebody's going to show me something that's going to suddenly make me stray away. and there is that incredible fear that people will be drawn. And yes, they may be drawn away from the traditional life as they foresee, as they live it in some cases. And sometimes they'll see that outside world and say, thank God I'm not a part of it. And frankly, with what we see going on with a lot of our world, the idea of being walled up in a monastery or some sort of secluded community where there is peace and comfort among it is kind of appealing every now and then. And I understand that too. But I just think that the dangers of these multiple walls being built around communities is ultimately taking us way back to places we don't want to be.
Dr. Julie Bells.
I've spent a lot of my academic career conducting research on internet-mediated partnerships. In particular, before I came to IU, I used to teach at Penn State, which is
I realize we probably ought to, I know what you mean, but we probably ought to tell the audience what you mean by internet-mediated.
Using things like email and chat systems to communicate with people in other locations. And I agree with what Rabbi Winnig is saying. Oftentimes we're in a situation in the United States where we do have populations that are relatively isolated with respect to coming in contact with different types of people. So when I conducted, you know, partnerships when I taught in Pennsylvania, oftentimes my students would say that the partnership that they engaged in my classes, using email to correspond with other students in Europe, was the first time that they had ever had prolonged interaction with a person from another culture. So what Rabbi Winnig is saying is a very real phenomenon within the United States for many people. And the other point that I wanted to make is that oftentimes the first time that we really see or cognize the self is through the mirror of the other. So if you don't have those opportunities when you're growing up to see yourself through the eyes of the other, through the mirror of the other, you don't gain kind of that meta perspective on yourself. And it can be a very scary situation to meet a person from another culture. However, I do think that there is really great opportunity in learning about others and in intercultural dialogue you know, to learn about the other. Recently, I read Rabbi Jill Jacobs' book, There Shall Be No Needy. It's a 2009 book, and it's about social justice agendas within the Jewish tradition. And, you know, as I was reading that text, in so many locations, I felt like Rabbi Jacobs could be talking about Islam, because the traditions are so similar. And when I was reading that, of course, I didn't feel threatened in my own faith. I felt invigorated and happy that, you know, there are so many other people out there that have a similar agenda to what I'm trying to do in social justice programs. So we see both sides. We see fear, but we also see affiliation and, energizing one another with this type of dialogue.
We've talked a lot, and it sounds, all of this sounds very reasonable, you know, and in part because we've got three thoughtful people in a room here who are worrying. How do you get past, though, the folks who have rage? I remember in one of my previous lives, I was the executive director of what was the Indiana Civil Liberties Union at the time, now is the ACLU of Indiana. And I was speaking at a forum down in southern Indiana, and referred to, I think we were talking about posting the Ten Commandments on the State House lawn, which was one of the cases at the time. And I referred to the Judeo-Christian tradition and had someone stand up and just start screaming about that as if there was no linkage whatsoever, again, in defiance of history and defiance of fact. But clearly, there was no opportunity for dialogue of any kind, academic or otherwise. How do we get past that? I'm going to go with David Carlson because, again, like a classroom, he got his hand up first. But I see Rabbi Winnick also wants to make a point. We'll try to get to that, too. David Carlson.
I think it's very important not to be angry at the fear and not to be fearful of the fear that we feel from particularly conservative people who struggle with the diversity in the culture. The one comment I would like to make is I think one of the ways that we help people do that is through truly understanding the emotional journey we're asking them to make. And that is from seeing theology is that all theologies are these beautiful paths to those that are taking that path. It's this powerful, it is this beautiful way of life. The problem is that many theologies become boxes. And so then a person is equating their theology with that God is in my box, in this box alone, meaning that everybody else needs to be in the same box with me. And that is a difficult thing to help people break down. But once a person begins to see that possibility, that theologies do not contain God, if they did, then they would be the God, not God himself. Once they begin to feel that, then they get a sense of how majestic is this diversity in the world, that God is the creator of all of this.
This is fascinating. We are talking right now about talking across faith traditions, having a fascinating discussion about the ways that we can get beyond fear and actually communicate across long traditions. We are fortunate to have as our guest in this special pre-recorded edition of No Limits, David Carlson, who is professor of philosophy and religion at Franklin College, Rabbi Paula Winnick, who is with the Bureau of Jewish Education, and Dr. Julie Bells, who is associate professor of applied linguistics, English, and world languages at Indiana University, Indianapolis. I am John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, executive editor of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We are talking about issues of faith and interfaith dialogue here on this special pre-recorded edition of No Limits. Our guests are David Carlson, who is professor at Franklin College, Paula Winnick, Rabbi Paula Winnick, who is the executive director of the Bureau of Jewish Education, Dr. Julie Bells, who is a professor at Indiana University at Indianapolis. Before the break, Rabbi Winnick, we were talking about how we move past the rage, basically. We've, I think, outlined how we conduct these kinds of conversations with people who are reasonably secure. How do we get to those who are not?
Unfortunately, in a world of insecurity, where we worry on a daily basis, and some people quite seriously worry on a daily basis about a roof over their head and food in their stomachs, until we solve some of those great social problems, it's very utopian to think that we can get past the rage in every aspect of life. Because frankly, there should be some rage at the state of the world today. There should be some rage at the insecurity that is heaped on many so that a few can have more, much more than they need to get on in life. And the fact that people are afraid and don't feel that they can look ahead and say, wow, this world is going to be better for me and my children in the future than it is for me today, and that I have a stake or an opportunity to have even a piece of the world's goodness that others have, I'm not certain we can get past everything. Because whenever there is a time of insecurity, people who are in power, who want to solidify power, know how to dig deep into those fears and capitalize on them. This morning, there was just a report about the elections in France and how they're using, yet again, baiting people's fear of Muslim takeover of France to get votes for the political campaign, and talking about the halal food as if it's somehow disrespectful to the world. And it's just so appalling to me that in this day and age, that any politician not only uses it, but actually gets more votes by doing so. And while that exists in our world, unfortunately, I'm not certain we can get past everything, because the security has to come from within, certainly. But frankly, it's very hard to tell somebody with no food on their plate and no hope for the future of their children that they should be faithful and supportive of others when they can't even find support for themselves. So I think we have a lot of world problems to solve in order to finally get to this peaceful understanding. But again, I get back to one other part of the education. Is right now we're talking among the three Abrahamic faith groups, where we can point to the common ancestor and the common faith tradition. We have a lot of other faith traditions out there that bring much beauty to our world and meaning to other people's lives who aren't part of these dialogues and are typically not part of these dialogues, because people get into the fact that they're polytheistic and we're monotheistic, and we're, and it gets back again to proving who's better or who's right and who we can even talk to, even in interfaith dialogues, because people might raise things that are traditionally outside and antagonistic, quote, for our traditions.
And to be, we had a little bit of fun with Rick Santorum earlier in the program, and to be fair to what I take would be his point, not having talked with him, it is that sometimes when we talk about faith and talk about resolving differences, it is that basically we're going to paper them over and that we're going to trivialize those differences, and that demeans faith and demeans faith traditions.
Absolutely.
I have not given, I know Dr. Bells has been waiting for a while to make a comment. It's like being in the classroom. I know you want to jump in on this.
I just wanted to say that I do agree with Rabbi Winnig that, you know, there are some disparity. There are many disparities, socioeconomic disparities and disparities of all kinds within our world today, social injustices, and definitely we have to work together to alleviate these. But I did want to point out that in the classroom, in the fields of foreign language education in particular, researchers have been developing pedagogies for a couple of decades that address some of these issues of fear of entering into intercultural or interfaith dialogues. And some of the things that I have done in my own classroom, you know, has been an extension and a development of some of these pedagogies. One of the first things that we have to do is that we have to engender and instill in people who are going to enter into an intercultural dialogue attitudes of curiosity and openness about the other. Okay, and that takes real uphill educational work. It's very difficult to just come cold to any type of an intercultural dialogue or an interfaith dialogue. One way to do things like this is to examine what is known as parallel texts. And a parallel text takes a common theme, but it is sometimes it's even written in two different languages. Mm-hmm. So Rabbi Winnig mentioned the verse of the Quran that I cited, and then she said that that also has origins and corollaries in Jewish scripture. So one thing to do would be to take a theme, like maybe a social justice theme, or hunger, or poverty, and take two texts from the different traditions and look at how they speak to those different issues or themes and examine those types of text in an interfaith dialogue. Another thing to do would be to engage in a little bit of debriefing work before you get in the intercultural dialogue. One thing that I do in my classroom is I take some moments of miscommunication and moments of intercultural contention from previous courses that I've taught. Mm-hmm. And prior to an actual intercultural encounter, I go over those with the participants to give them an idea of what they might expect and how they might manage some of their affective reactions to particular statements. So much of this is explained in the academic pedagogy for these types of encounters.
Rabbi Winnig.
I was just going to kind of jump in and say that the language issue in America mm-hmm. in dialogue is a huge issue mm-hmm. because we are among the most illiterate in other languages mm-hmm. of any peoples in the world. And that creates its own set of fears, because if you can't communicate with the other or even have a basic understanding, you become prickly. I know that when I travel overseas, when I go to countries where mm-hmm. I know the language or have at least some facility, I feel much more comfortable in my surroundings. When you go someplace and you can't even read road signs to know where you're going, and you can't have even a normal hello, how are you conversation, you feel on a little bit off. And that so much of that comes from the fact that in America, we speak English, we teach English, and we teach it almost exclusively. Our foreign language, if it comes in at all to children's lives, comes in at the middle school to high school level, rather than at preschool and kindergarten level, where they would be much more comfortable with learning foreign languages. Our preschool actually now teaches Hebrew and Spanish mm-hmm. beginning at age 3. And that was done to make certain that we were raising children with a multicultural component to their lives so that they would feel comfortable in every context that they might encounter around them. And we hope that that will engender them some sense of security, go on and explore other languages more deeply as they get older.
We could talk about this an awful lot, but something both of you have said triggers is, and I want to be very careful how I frame this, because if I frame it wrong, it's going to enrage a lot of people, but is some of the issue here sort of the idea of American exceptionalism? The fact that you know, as our founding myth in some ways is yeah. that the people who created this country withdrew from this, you know, the corrupt rest of the world.
Absolutely.
We built the city on the hill and all of that. And that means we're talking about traditions here that are thousands of years old.
Yeah.
Part of the myth, then, is that we rejected much of that.
Mm-hmm.
Is that at the issue? I saw you all nodding your heads, but head nods aren't effective radio, so we actually need words here. I'll start with David Carlson, then Rabbi Winnig, and Dr. Julie Bells.
A voice that meant a lot to me at the beginning of my interview project was I heard Nathan Dungan on public radio. I'm not sure how to characterize him. He's kind of an economist, but he's also a social commentator. And just as I was considering setting up these interviews with monks and nuns around the country, he said on, I think it was Speaking of Faith was the name of the program at that time. I think it's changed since then. But he said that 9/11 offered this country an opportunity for reflection, but he said it was an opportunity largely missed. And I do believe that part of what might have been reflected upon after 9/11 was this idea of exceptionalism. And in a sense, 9/11 promoted the bubble effect that we are exceptional. Mm-hmm. This pain was greater than anybody else's pain in the world, rather than the fact that, unfortunately, what happened to us, it happens frequently.
Yeah.
And so it could have been a bridging moment. We could have one of the monks, even before I made the visit to Gethsemane Abbey, he sent me something that he had heard, and that was that Rabbi Giuliani was, right after 9/11, was offered a huge amount of money from some Middle Eastern sheikh, and with the stipulation that we will give you this money if America would take some time to think on how she acts in the world. And Giuliani rejected the money, which was for the monk and for myself this sort of comment like, we're not here to do any reflection. We have nothing that we need to rethink. We have no changes to make. And
we're perfect just the way we
are. We're fine. And 9/11, yeah, as we were told by the government, was we were being attacked because we were free and that we were prosperous. In other words, we constructed reasons for 9/11 that flattered us,
mm-hmm,
rather than asked us to rethink ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Rabbi Paula Winning.
It's funny that you mentioned that, because on the morning of September 11th, I was actually hosting at my synagogue, which at the time I was a congregational rabbi in New York,
mm-hmm,
an interfaith group of the Interfaith Clergy Association of our area. It was supposed to be our first meeting of the year. And the meeting was scheduled to begin at 9:30. And of course, 8 o'clock is when everything happened.
Mm-hmm.
And what was interesting is we had 100% participation of people showing up,
mm-hmm,
because we as clergy needed to meet together.
Absolutely.
We needed to sit together and figure out what had just happened. And we also were kind of concerned about who had people where and when, because we were the communities that sent workers downtown to Wall Street and to the Twin Towers. And as we were at our meeting is when the towers fell. So we prayed together. We planned to get together again in a few days to assess what had happened. Interestingly, what had happened was the opposite of what we'd expected. My congregation and many of the Jewish congregations had very few deaths. The priest who was the priest of an area in Far Rockaway,
mm-hmm,
unfortunately had over 23 deaths of firefighters and police officers in his congregation. And we mourned together. And I think that personally, I would not have gotten through that time,
mm-hmm,
as a leader of a congregation were it not for my interfaith, mm-hmm, colleagues helping us support each other. We saw it as a great opportunity to be together and to demonstrate the better part of what our world could be.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. And for the first year or so after,
mm-hmm,
that dialogue continued and those relationships continued very strongly. Unfortunately, what happened right after that was fatigue.
Mm-hmm.
And people stopped talking and people stopped caring, and the rewriting of the story by the first anniversary,
yeah,
and certainly now by the 10th and 11th anniversaries, has,
mm-hmm,
changed.
Yeah.
And that moment in time that could have been,
yeah,
has been so lost. And it's really a shame, because it was an opportunity for us to say, we're all part of the American dream. What can we do to make that dream actually be fulfilled?
Well, is there I'm going to slightly reframe the question here and give Julie Bells the first crack at it, and just say, you know, out of the mid-20th century cataclysm of World War II, there is a post-Holocaust theology that began to emerge. Do we need a post-9/11 theology where we begin re-examining premises based on this? I mean, the idea, most people, frankly, would say, would not think of 9/11 as an opportunity. But Dr. Julie Bells.
I thought that 9/11 was an awesome opportunity for people to get to know one another. And I agree that that opportunity was largely lost. I want to respond to your a bit to your comment about American exceptionalism by just giving a little bit of an idea of some of the research on learning second languages. And Rabbi Winnig mentioned that in the United States, we tend to delay foreign language education, if we offer it at all, until the high school years. And actually, this curricular structure flies in the face of everything we know from the research perspective of how second languages are learned. I also wanted to mention, too, that this idea of being, you know, multiculturally competent individual, we have robust research findings that show that individuals who are familiar with more than one language perform better on a battery of cognitive tests than monolingual speakers.
We have been talking today here on No Limits about issues of faith and the importance of interfaith dialogue. Been fortunate to have as our guests David Carlson of Franklin College. David, thank you for spending this time with us.
Thank you very much, and thank you to the others here, too.
Certainly. Rabbi Paula Winnig, who is the Executive Director of the Bureau of Jewish Education. Rabbi Winnig, thank you for spending this time
My
with
pleasure.
Us. And Dr. Julie Bells, who is Associate Professor of Applied Linguistics, English, and World Languages at Indiana University in Indianapolis. Thank you for spending this time with us.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
We will be back next week. Take care.